This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are exposed. And in this new series, we investigate the dark side of the wellness industry, following the story of a woman who joined a yoga school only to uncover a world she never expected.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this.
Where the hope of spiritual breakthroughs leaves people vulnerable to exploitation.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
World of Secrets, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is Andrew Peach. Welcome to World Business Report from the BBC. In Canada, Justin Trudeau is out, but will a change at the top make any difference to the threat of US trade tariffs? I've been talking to a former finance minister.
He's made himself the entire focus of his government. He's been in office now for 9 years, and people were tired of him.
Donald Trump says drill, baby, drill. But with 2 weeks left in office, President Biden bans new offshore oil and gas drilling in US coastal waters. What can you get for $9 a day? The chance to drive into Manhattan with its new congestion charge. And Netflix is taking another step into live sport. After 9 years in the top job in Canadian politics, Justin Trudeau is stepping down as leader of the governing Liberal Party and, as a result, as Prime Minister.
I intend to resign as party leader, as Prime Minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process.
The Liberals are trailing in the opinion polls ahead of an expected election in October. That pressure ramped up considerably last month when, as you may have heard on World Business Report, the Finance Minister and Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, quit in a row with Mr. Trudeau over trade tariffs threatened by Donald Trump, whose election win was certified in the US Senate today. The outgoing Prime Minister set out what he thinks his government has delivered for Canadian voters and businesses.
We were elected for the third time in 2021, to strengthen the economy post-pandemic and advance Canada's interests in a complicated world. And that is exactly the job that I and we will continue to do for Canadians.
So what are Canadian businesses thinking about his resignation and about an incoming US president who's still talking about trade tariffs? Dan Kelly is president of the Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses. I asked him what the threatened tariff of 25% on all Canada's exports to the US might mean.
Oh gosh, tariffs are a big deal in Canada. We are a trading nation with a small population. So much of our economy is based on export. That tariffs, especially given that with the size of the U.S., our neighbor, that would be a real job killer in Canada. And it even goes further than that, though. Not just export-related tariffs become problematic for small and medium-sized firms, but typically governments react by imposing tariffs of their own. So our government might do retaliatory measures. And as a result, even imports then become much more expensive as we try to sort out the trade mess. This is a big deal.
What are the worries you've got about what that would all mean for the Canadian economy and for businesses who you represent?
I don't think that there would be any way for Canada to avoid a fairly severe recession if we have any long-term use of tariffs with our largest trading partner. Three quarters of Canada's trade is with the United States. We are as deeply dependent on them as it gets. And so this threat is serious, and we need to take it in that direction.
But which sectors particularly do you think would be hit?
Well, clearly manufacturers would be hit very, very quickly. There is potential, of course, for some of our energy exports to be exempt from those taxes, as that would be very problematic for U.S. domestic consumers. But look, all is not lost. I'm hoping that cooler heads can prevail, even with the political instability that we're facing in Canada. Perhaps, in fact, the resignation of the Prime Minister may mean that this is a little bit easier for us to get out at this stage.
And back to Donald Trump's tariffs. Do you think he means it? Or is this just some kind of bargaining position on his part to get something he wants from Canada?
The president has definitely used all sorts of policy levers to try to negotiate deals. That is what he's best known for and is quite good at. Look, I'm hoping, and many believe, that this we may be able to negotiate our way out of this, but we sure can't take that for granted. We have to act as if this is an absolute serious and an existential threat and put in place all of the measures possible to avoid it.
That was Dan Kelly from the Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses. I've also been getting reaction to today's developments from John Manley, former Canadian finance minister, and like Justin Trudeau, a liberal.
He was right to resign. He clearly had lost the support of his caucus. You know, the difficulty of running a campaign after his deputy prime minister and minister of finance had written a public letter expressing a lack of confidence in him. Those are pretty tough odds to run against. So it was the right time for him to do so.
What's he done wrong? I mean, we've heard from business leaders in Canada on the program already who are saying that the problem with Justin Trudeau is the economy was never his priority.
Well, the economy was never his priority, but that's not what he's done wrong. What he's done wrong is that he's made himself the entire focus of his government. He's been in office now for 9 years, and people were tired of him. It's very hard to last more than 9 or 10 years in a democratic system.
What should Canada be doing to take on the threat of tariffs from the US?
The problem here, of course, is that we know that Donald Trump smells weakness the way a shark smells blood in the water. And if he thinks that there's weakness here, he'll pounce on it for whatever objective that he is pursuing. And that's going to be difficult. It's going to be important that other political actors in Canada speak up on Canadian interests as well.
Who's the right person to deal with Donald Trump? Is it Chrystia Freeland, who resigned as finance minister and in the end brought down Justin Trudeau? Is it Mark Carney? Who would you back?
Well, I'm not ready to back anybody in that particular race. I think that it's going to be important for whoever is ultimately the chosen to be the Liberal leader that they show some distance from Prime Minister Trudeau. That's pretty easy for Mark Carney. It's become easier for Chrystia Freeland, given that she was the one that really, you know, hung a bell around the neck of the cat in this case and has precipitated what happened today. So both of them have some distance from Trudeau, and I think others would have to do so in what will admittedly be a bit of an abbreviated campaign by Canadian standards. They'll have to do it during that campaign.
And John, finally, you've talked about the bits of the Canadian economy that might be able to be part of some kind of fight back against US tariffs. Which bits of the Canadian economy will be most hurt by them?
Some of the same ones, because that's an important market to us. And, you know, I think it's high time we got our act together and particularly in the natural resource sector, built the pipelines necessary to move some of our product to overseas markets other than the United States. That's our bad. We've been slow to do it. We've been reluctant to do it. We haven't seen the need to do it, quite honestly. And that's not something you do overnight.
And that was the former Canadian finance minister, John Manley, talking to World Business Report. Let's bring in Peter Jankowskis now, Vice President of Research and Analysis at Arbor Financial Services, live with us from Chicago. Peter, the problem Canada's got is that it needs the US so much more than the US needs Canada, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Canadian economy is more than one third exports, and of those exports, about three quarters of them are to the US. So that's a very dramatic dependency there. And on the US side, you know, roughly 15% of the economy here is imports. There's a fair amount of trade with Canada, but you know, overall, it's very, very small within the context of the U.S. economy.
If the tariffs are introduced as advertised, John Manley was saying, well, Canada could fight back by putting tariffs on bourbon imports and one or two things that, you know, are going in the other direction. Would that make any difference? Would that bother the Trump administration at all?
I don't think it would. I'd say the one area where they likely have some leverage is in the auto industry. because there are some very close relationships there with U.S. manufacturers that would put that industry in particular in distress. And that's likely to see some impact that the Trump administration would find it very difficult to ignore.
Now, I said if the tariffs come in as advertised, because there's been a lot of talk all over the place today that maybe they'll be much reduced in scope, quite specific tariffs. And some people are believing it because the dollar's been falling off the back of that reporting.
Yes, I think some people are anticipating it. President-elect Trump has come out and said that he is not backing down from any of that. But of course, from a negotiating standpoint, that's exactly what he would have to say. So I think realistically, people are seeing the potential fallout that these tariffs could have around the world and are expecting that because of that, they will be scaled back.
And from Trump's point of view, from the US's point of view, why start a trade war with Canada or any other country? But you really might want to leverage the possibility of one to achieve some specific goals, some specific policy goals.
Yes, I think that likely is the case, that the real interest is not tariffs or tariff income, but some other quid pro quo that the Trump administration would find advantageous.
Peter, stay with us. More with Peter on the way. This is World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Peach, Joe Biden has 14 days left in the White House, but he's not done. He's announced a ban on offshore oil and gas drilling in most US coastal waters, the idea being to protect areas like the Bering Sea off Alaska and the eastern Gulf of Mexico from any further development, maybe an attempt to secure the environmental parts of the Biden legacy. Donald Trump says he'll overturn all of this the moment he enters the White House. That might be easier said than done, though, as I've been hearing from our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury, in New York.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ban which prevents oil companies from leasing waters for new drilling along parts of the US coastline is, in many ways, an attempt to protect Joe Biden's climate legacy from President-elect Donald Trump. Because you may remember that certainly one of the common chants at his rallies has been drill, baby, drill. This is someone also who has downplayed the effects of climate change. And so what we have here with this executive order is an attempt to sort of put a marker down and kind of leave a legacy, as I say, on sort of climate and the environment that he can stand by.
Seems a bit ridiculous, though, for the system to allow a president who's very nearly at the end of his term of office to be making a decision for the long-term future when we know that the guy who's going to be president in a few days would never, ever pass such an executive order.
Well, and I think that's some of the anger we're seeing right now is that, as you say, Donald Trump was elected and he ran on a sort of campaign of drilling more, of unleashing drilling in the United States and increasing its energy production levels. It is part of the US system, which comes with checks and balances. And interestingly enough, the law that he is using to kind of enact this decree, the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, is unusually hard to undo. In fact, the Trump administration has to rely on Congress to help change the law, which dates back to 1953. Not impossible, given he will control both chambers, that the Republicans will, but they will still need to make sure they don't lose any votes, and it might take some bipartisanship to get it done.
That's interesting. So Donald Trump's already said, this is ridiculous, I'll overturn it immediately. I don't think he's actually said day one, as he does for so many things. But that's going to be easier said than done. As we saw with the government shutdown last month, he might have a majority in both houses, but he still needs every single Republican on side.
Yeah, and so it's certainly going to be something I think we'll see them work on, in part because it is something they campaigned on. And what was interesting is, if you look at the statement from the American Petroleum Institute, they said they want policymakers to use every tool at their disposal to reverse what they are calling a politically motivated decision. So there you have it, the industry voice railing against today's move by Joe Biden and basically urging the incoming administration and policymakers to kind of try and reverse it.
I was going to ask you about the drilling industry. They don't know whether they're coming or going now.
I mean, what's interesting about all of this is the context against which this is happening. Oil production in America was at its highest under Joe Biden. But at the same time, he has also worked very hard to diversify America's sources of energy. So providing tax credits to develop cleaner energy. Whereas if you look at incoming President Donald Trump, he is very much sort of the kind of drill, baby, drill. And that is the expectation from oil majors. And so you're seeing this reaction from the industry of one of dismay. There was another group which described the call today as an attack on the oil and natural gas industry. And I think that's what many feel, even though the reality is that oil production increased under Joe Biden as well.
Our North America business correspondent, Michelle Fleury, with me from New York. Now, if you want to experience the Lullaby of Broadway, it's going to cost you $9. That's $9 per day, because New York now has a congestion charge. 400 lanes of traffic watched by 1,400 enforcement cameras in a zone that stretches from the south of Central Park through the Empire State Building, Times Square, all the way down to Wall Street. The aim is to ease traffic congestion and raise billions of dollars for the subway network. John McDonough has been driving a cab in New York for more than 40 years. He is strongly critical, I think it's fair to say, of the congestion charge and of New York City leaders.
To me, it's a complete disaster. This is added on to all the other taxes. There's a wheelchair tax. There are so many taxes, you can barely fit it onto the meter at the moment. It will have nothing to do with congestion in Manhattan. What's wrong with going on in Manhattan with the traffic is the street design. Because now we have bus lanes on one side, we have bank lanes on the other side, we got concrete barriers up. So we're confined into one lane wherever we're going. So there's constant traffic. So they create the problem, and then they say, well, the solution to that problem is now we're going to charge you $9 to come in. And it'll have no effect on congestion. It's just a tax on the working class in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx. That's all it is.
Live to Tiffany Ann Taylor, Vice President of the Transportation at the Regional Plan Association, one of the people who's come up with this and developed this policy. Thank you for being with us on World Business Report. Let me invite you to talk to John, the cabbie, and persuade him.
Hi, yes, good evening. Hi. Thank you for having me. You know, I think it's really important to remember that the streets are a resource that should be shared by more than just a driver. I am a driver myself, and that is by choice. But there are many folks in the city and in the region who have to use or have preferred to use public transportation, whether it's bus, whether it's subway or bikes. And so there should be an opportunity to share the street space, not just for private drivers. And also, we need to continue to invest in the public transportation system. We have a system that runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365, and many parts of it are over 100 years old. And the health and sustainability of that system is really important, not just for New York City, but our region and arguably the rest of the United States.
How will we know if it's worked? If it's about raising money for infrastructure, for the subway, how much money? If it's about reducing traffic congestion, how much more quickly would you be able to drive around Manhattan if this policy had been successful?
I think it's going to take some time, hopefully not too much. I think one bucket might be more visible than the other. I think very shortly we'll be able to see what the revenue generation of the system actually looks like. We have a sense of the volume of traffic that typically happens before this program, and there is infrastructure and software available now, including license plate readers and things like that, that can tell us what have the traffic movements been like since, you know, Sunday at 12:01 when the program started. And we're looking forward to, you know, information being produced by the MTA and the state to have a better sense of what that's meant. In terms of actually looking at congestion itself, I think that's also going to take a little bit of time because humans by nature take a little bit of time to change their patterns, change their behaviors, really understand how a policy like this will impact either their wallet directly or the time spent or the time saved in making different decisions on their mobility.
I mean, I get it's a complicated issue, but if that's the definition of success or failure, we'll never know, will we? We'll never know whether it's worked or not.
No, I don't think that's fair. I think there are a lot of things that still take time. I think it's premature to think that as soon as you turn a program like this on immediately, that you would be able to see the results. I hope that hasn't been the assumption that folks have. This is for the first time in the United States, the first time that a program like this has been enacted. So I think it's fair to say that it's going to take a little bit of time. I'm not saying, you know, months and months, but at least a couple of days to understand what the traffic patterns really look like and how much money the state is generating.
You must have other cities asking you about it, going, oh, maybe we could do this.
Yeah, absolutely. When the program was first approved by the MTA board last spring, we had Toronto reach out to us. I believe we also had Boston and I believe Los Angeles as well. I'm sure others, you know, have had perhaps quieter conversations, but absolutely other cities across the United States are looking to New York, as they often do, for if not just a way to replicate, but perhaps to be inspired to find creative ways to solve their congestion and air quality issues as well.
If you admit to being part of the group of people who've developed this, let's say at, you know, parties over Thanksgiving and Christmas, do people give you a hard time?
Yes, I think you can say that's the case. But also I'm a New Yorker, I'm born and raised, and so I'm not really afraid of conflict. Listen, things that are difficult, things that can be good for us often feel difficult. Change is also difficult as well. And to be quite honest, if there were easier ways to find more sustainable and creative pots of funding, we would have made those decisions already. And because we haven't, this is where we are, and this is a new path forward.
Tiffany Ann Taylor, thank you very much indeed for being with us. Now, this is coming to Netflix. John Cena and Co. making their debut on the streaming service today after it acquired the WWE Raw Wrestling Show. It's part of a broader pivot into live sport for Netflix with American football games and that Beyonce halftime show over Christmas. They've also recently announced exclusive US broadcasting rights for the Women's Football World Cups in 2027 and 2031. Ed Dessa is president of Dessa Media, which is a sports media consultancy in California. I asked him why Netflix suddenly got so sporty.
I think it has a lot to do with the fact that they've dominated other forms of entertainment, and it's one of the few remaining things for them to add in order to be a full-service operation. I'd hasten to add that the news might be on the horizon as well.
Doesn't that dilute what Netflix is as a proposition, though, to be going into live broadcasting as well? It's not what we understand Netflix to be.
Has morphed from being a purely, you know, movie and TV show related platform to being an entertainment platform more broadly. And if we look at the history of entertainment platforms, they have a variety of different sorts of content, and this seems to be following that path. Now that they're going to be adding, you know, WWE a step beyond, and of course the World Cup rights in a couple of years for the U.S. is going to take them further down that road. But at this juncture, I view this as being data gathering for a very data intensive company.
So it's like a giant experiment that we're all involved in. But on the other hand, it's pretty big, isn't it? They already bought up the rights to some of these sports you've been mentioning.
Yes, well, and they're looking very closely at what Amazon Prime has done, as Amazon has EPL rights.
Yes.
And has rights to both the NFL and NBA now. And so I think you can see this as perhaps some peer pressure to stake out a position in areas that they haven't previously been in. And I recognize that this is really a turnabout for them, because they started their lives deciding that they would only focus on so-called long-tail programming, things that had a library value, and they were disinterested in sports. So they've made a switch to focus on some sports, at least now, and gather that information.
Where does this leave linear television that was already struggling against the streamers?
Well, you're quite right. It is a threat to linear television, but I would hasten to add that linear television still has the vast preponderance of live sports. They've continued to invest in live sports, and you know, this does drive up their cost for doing so. But I think that you know, the linear networks have figured out that they can't rely solely on entertainment. They need to focus on sports. And so they have done so. And we're seeing that a very substantial number of the highest rated linear telecasts are now increasingly of sports programming.
And just to pick up something you said earlier, Ed, very interesting, the concept of Netflix also wanting to get into news.
I'm not saying that they have indicated an interest in getting into news. I just recognize that is one, perhaps the last frontier. We did see that Amazon, for the U.S. elections, mounted a newscast to cover Election Day, featuring former NBC anchor Brian Williams. So there is at least some interest in news among streamers. I'm not saying that Netflix has that high on their list, but it's certainly a possibility down the road.
Edessa with me from California. Meanwhile, in Chicago, Peter Jankowski from Arbor Financial Services is still with us on World Business Report. Is it diluting what Netflix is, do you think, to go into new areas of live news and sport?
Well, I wouldn't view it as that. I think it is kind of exploring other areas. They still have a very strong offering in new production of long-form dramas and such. So that's still there. But they probably are seeing some competition from Prime in terms of their movement there. I think it's also important to point out that Netflix has a pretty strong advantage when it comes to client retention compared to many of these other services. So I think they're just trying to make sure that they don't miss out on something that will cause people to migrate to other services and be very loyal to those services rather than Netflix.
So you've got to keep developing as a business, otherwise someone else comes along and becomes the one-stop shop, and then suddenly your market share is being eaten away, all of that.
Absolutely.
Peter, it's a good job you were here, because this is where I show I'm not a business person, I'm a radio presenter. Thank you very much indeed for being with us, Peter. I greatly appreciate it. From Chicago, that's Peter Jankowski. And that's it from the team here at World Business Report. You'll find more online if you go to bbc.com/news and then click on the business tab. And thank you for being with us here on the BBC World Service.
Delve into a world of secrets. The BBC's Global Investigations podcast, breaking major news stories around the world.
A BBC investigation finds that Mohamed Al-Fayed, former owner of Harrods, was accused of raping five members of staff.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
From the top of British society to the heart of global fashion brands.
The former boss of clothing brand Abercrombie and Fitch is accused of exploiting young men for sex.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
Gripping investigations, available to listen to now, with more coming soon. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts, and click follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.